5 long years in the army, it never was a home. Take me back to my hometown and nevermore I'll roam. I'm looking for...
After the Nazis surrendered in Germany, millions of Americans serving in the armed forces during World War II began coming home.
My first day in my hometown, I spent looking for a bed, tramping up and down those avenues for a place to lay my head. I'm a looking for a home.
I'm a looking for a home.
I'm a looking for a home.
I'm looking for a home.
I'm a looking for a home.
I'm looking for a home.
I'm a looking for a home.
I'm looking for a home.
Men and women raised in the Great Depression and transformed by war returned to a different America, one of increasing hope, prosperity, and strength. The federal government had organized and led two historic triumphs over the Depression in the 30s and the Nazis in the 40s. For what would later be called the greatest generation, government was a force to help the elderly, the sick, and the poor. As the Second World War came to a close, the United States was about to experiment with the greatest set of benefits for returning soldiers in its history, a program that would transform the entire country.
While concentrating on military victory, we are today laying plans for the return to civilian life of our gallant men and women in the armed services.
Since the beginning of the war, veterans groups and the Roosevelt administration had been strategizing about how to reintegrate this army of veterans back into society.
I have assured our men in the armed forces that the American people would not let them down when the war is won.
The passage of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, also known as the GI Bill of Rights, is widely credited with transforming American society and expanding the middle class to create the longest period of sustained prosperity in the country's history.
Never before had the U.S. government spent so much money to better the lives of its citizens.
The GI Bill actually took a nation of what I'll call uneducated renters and made this country a nation of educated homeowners.
It had a profound impact on creating American middle class. The GI Bill, very directly. There's no question about it.
That's why I'm marching. Yes, I'm marching. Marching down freedom's road. Hand me my gun. Let the bugle blow loud. I'm on my way with my head up proud. One objective I've got in view is to keep a hold of freedom for me and you. That's why I'm born.
Imagine for a moment a different modern America, a country without Microsoft and without one of history's largest charitable givers, the Gates Foundation. Imagine no Beat Generation, no home for Jack Kerouac's On the Road or Allen Ginsberg's Howl. Imagine a still segregated America, one without black elected leaders because they never had the opportunity to be heard. Now listen as former Congressional Black Caucus leader Ronald Dellums, City Lights bookstore founder Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Gates Foundation chairman Bill Gates Sr. tell their stories about how the GI Bill transformed the United States in the hopeful days following the end of the Second World War. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is the story of the GI Bill. To understand the GI Bill, we have to go back to another war, the Great War, World War I. Most soldiers returning from the trenches of northern France got almost nothing when they came home. When the Great War ended in 1919, the government paid soldiers $1 for each day served, $1.25 for time overseas. But soldiers who had sacrificed for their country believed the nation owed them something more in return for their service. Because of that widespread discontent, Congress passed a law in 1924 to give veterans an additional dollar per day served.
There was a veteran's bonus, if you will, that was to be paid about 20 years after the law was enacted.
Dennis Douglas heads the Education Service in the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. He says while the veterans waited out the 20 years to get their bonuses, the Great Depression struck, leaving many veterans destitute.
And these veterans felt, well, I'm owed this money.
Professor Kathleen Friedel of the University of California at Berkeley says 90% of those veterans demanded to be paid immediately.
The federal government has promised me this money. And so they undertook a march, or I should say an infamous march.
In May of 1932, thousands of World War I vets began gathering in Washington, D.C., some with their wives and children, to force the government to pay them their bonuses. Dennis Douglas.
And this was a sorry spectacle that veterans would have to march on Washington to get benefits they were promised.
Over 25,000 veterans and their families camped where they could find space, in parks and abandoned buildings. They became known as the Bonus Marchers. Kathleen Friedel.
That was 1932. It's Hoover's presidency, and one of the more salient signs that many Bonus Marchers carried with them was a sign that read, Wilson's Heroes, Hoover's Bombs, meaning we fought for Woodrow Wilson and, you know, we're the country's heroes, and now we are bombs out on the streets selling apples.
After 2 months, tent cities were well entrenched along the Potomac River. The largest was in Anacostia Flats. On July 28th, police and veterans clashed in a downtown demonstration. Police opened fire, killing at least one vet. President Hoover then ordered the army to clear the camps. General Douglas MacArthur led mounted troopers brandishing swords, followed by machine guns and two infantry regiments.
Today, one policeman and one bonus marcher were killed in skirmishes with local police, prompting President Hoover to order the U.S. Army, under the leadership of General Douglas MacArthur, to remove...
Horses charged. Gas grenades flew. Professor Friedel.
Not only did he clear the veterans who were marched into Washington, but he pursued them on into Anacostia, where they were camped out, and fire started, and it was a really horrendous scene.
And so they're being forced out of their shacks by smoke bombs and tear gas, hurled by the troops who have been called out by the President of the United States.
Gas fumes killed two babies. The veterans were finally ousted from their protest camps. But the rout backfired disastrously for Hoover.
Well, attacking veterans, right? So it's an incredibly traumatic event, and not just because it's traumatic, there were fires and people were injured, but it's symbolically quite traumatic.
4 months later, Hoover was defeated by Franklin Roosevelt. Still, President Roosevelt proved to be no friend to the veterans.
The American Legion took him to task for what he did in his first 100 days as president, which, among the other things he did, was pass the so-called Economy Act, which repealed the bonus.
But 9 years later, President Roosevelt would be forced to think differently when the country came under attack.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
When Japanese planes devastated Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, there were mass enlistments all over the country.
Well, it was the good war. And I did it as a matter of self-preservation and social acceptability.
City Lights bookstore founder Lawrence Ferlinghetti helped launch the Beat Movement. From his office overlooking San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood, he remembers enlisting in the Navy in 1941.
Well, no, we weren't frightened. We're, you know, fools rush in where angels fear to tread.
The American population was extremely mad.
Again, Dennis Douglas of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
You had 14 and 15-year-old boys that were lying about their age so that they could enlist and fight the Germans or the Japanese, or, you know, they were following perhaps their older brothers. In some instances, may have been even following uncles off to war.
I got a brother in the infantry, I thought you knowed. I got a brother in the infantry, he's way down that road. I got a brother in the infantry, and he smokes cigarettes same as me, and I'm gonna put my name down.
While concentrating on military victory, we're not neglecting the planning of the things to come.
Throughout the early World War II years, Congress struggled with, how to take care of bringing these people back and not having a repeat of what happened in after World War I.
They must not be demobilized into an environment of inflation and unemployment, to a place on the breadline or on a corner selling apples. We must this time have plans ready.
There were going to be anywhere between 12 and 16 million service members coming off active duty and needing employment of some sort in order to assimilate back into the economy.
Over 600 separate pieces of veterans legislation were introduced in Congress during the war years, but there was great debate over what the benefits should be. Then, in a nationally broadcast fireside chat on July 28, 1943, President Roosevelt shared his vision for supporting returning soldiers.
The least to which they're entitled, it seems to me, is something like this. First, mustering out pay, large enough in each case to cover a reasonable period of time between his discharge and the finding of a new job. Secondly, in case no job is found after diligent search, then unemployment insurance, if the individual registers with the United States Employment Service. Third, an opportunity for members of the armed services to get further education or trade training at the cost of their government. Fourth, allowance of credit to all members of the armed forces under unemployment compensation and federal old age and survivors insurance for their period of service.
But years of arguing between Congress and the president made FDR's inspired rhetoric ring hollow for many lawmakers. That is, until the veterans lobby stepped in. Again, UC Berkeley professor Kathleen Friedel.
And really, the work of the GI Bill was performed by the American Legion and conservatives within Congress, and it was their vision that really guided the bill and produced, I would say, its political legitimacy.
There was a lot of thought and a lot of discussion.
The VA's Dennis Douglas.
But it wasn't until an American Legion member, Harry Colmery, actually sat down in the Mayflower Hotel over a couple of evenings and hand wrote what became the starting point for the Servicemen's Readjustment Act.
Colmery envisioned several broad benefits designed to help homecoming veterans with their return to America. For example,
if you're accepted at any university or school or vocational on-the-job training program that an individual state can vouch for, you can go there and the GI Bill will pay for it, as well as provide you with a stipend while you attend that school.
Kathleen Friedel says vets could also receive medical care and a mortgage or a farm loan. And
Title V was the unemployment compensation benefit, which provided 52 weeks of $20 checks. So it was commonly referred to as 5220.
Well, the bill was written with the veteran in mind. Friedel says there was also an ulterior motive.
One of the things that drove the GI Bill was the attempt of the American Legion to nominate their organization as superior to other competing veterans organizations, namely the Veterans of Foreign Wars. They wanted members. So if every war produces its own organization, the American Legion has this organizational epiphany and says, what if we articulate an organizational strategy that captures veterans of other wars as well? Here are 16 million men who are fighting in World War II. Let's try to come up with some kind of post-war readjustment program.
And so the bill that would transform America went to Congress. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act was introduced in Congress on January 10, 1944. The VA's Dennis Douglas says the reaction was mixed.
There were a lot of people who were positive about some features and quite honestly, negative about others. The educational community was not enamored with the educational features of the GI Bill. They believed that if passed, the quality of their student on college campuses would go down.
But Professor Friedel says the American Legion gained a powerful ally when publishing giant William Randolph Hearst became a strong backer of their bill.
And so they bring the whole package of benefits in early January to the Hearst PR men. And one of them says, you know, economic readjustment, da-da-da bill that has all the political appeal of a castrated mule. And they finally land on the GI Bill of Rights. And that's actually, very interesting that they landed on that language, because Franklin Roosevelt had just given a State of the Union address where he talks about a new Bill of Rights for American people. So these guys say, Bill of Rights, we like that. And they take that, in a sense, again, from Roosevelt.
The American Legion began producing two-minute promotional newsreels to run before motion pictures. They created 400 one-minute radio announcements by wounded GIs. Professor Friedel says Hearst's men presented a petition with 1 million signatures in favor of the GI Bill.
You know, the GI Bill was good politics. Everybody knew a veteran, and so they were going to vote for the plan that was designed for the veterans, you know, whichever plan that was. And the GI Bill obviously was the plan to vote for, although it did battle with these other New Deal competing programs. By the time the legislation was introduced on the floor of the Senate, it had 80 co-signers. So when you have 80 co-authors of a bill, it's a pretty good bet that that bill's going to pass.
The bill passed the Senate and the House by unanimous vote. But as is often the case, the details of the bill had to be worked out between the two houses. The great political battles were still ahead. Professor Kathleen Friedel.
In a very interesting twist of events, the primary supporter and mover of the GI Bill, Congressman John Rankin from Mississippi, Democrat from Mississippi, you know, he had chaired the World War Veterans Legislation Committee and successfully brokered this peace between the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the VFW. And so he had guided this bill for many months now. And he was, in the end, in the final analysis, the greatest obstruction to its passing. He became greatly concerned that the World War II GI Bill would enable black veterans to return to Mississippi and receive, for instance, 52 weeks of $20 a week. Now, that doesn't sound that generous to you or to me or maybe even to veterans at the time, but it totally undermined the wage differential, which buttressed segregation in the South. It really was a challenge to his social order to have black veterans thus empowered. So he wanted to be sure that the bill was administered in a way that state and local power would have the final say in who gets what and how much.
While Rankin played politics in Washington, across the Atlantic, the military planned an invasion of Europe.
D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress.
I was a mile and a half off the beach. We were partly stove in by another ship.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti was one of 150,000 Allied soldiers who invaded Normandy on June 6, 1944.
We were an anti-submarine screen around the beaches in Normandy, but we didn't have to land. We could look through the binoculars and seeing the GIs getting shot up on the beaches.
More than 4,000 Allied soldiers died during the invasion. But their sacrifice gave the Allies a necessary foothold on the European mainland, turning the tide of war. Coming up, as the Allies battle in Europe, Congress fights over veterans' benefits.
And he marches into the conference room the next morning, and he says, you know, while our boys are dying on the shores of Normandy, why are we stalling for passing a benefit program for them?
The historically poor treatment of veterans forced politicians like President Roosevelt to consider how to reintegrate returning World War II soldiers into society.
They must not be demobilized into an environment of inflation and unemployment, to a place on the breadline or on a corner selling apples.
But Congress couldn't agree on what benefits returning veterans should receive. In June of 1944, soldiers had other urgent battles to fight.
We are on the beach today, on D-Day. These boys are apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches. It's not very pleasant. It's exposed.
The Allies' successful assault on the beaches of Normandy in Europe gave a boost to the champions of veterans' benefits back at home.
If anything, there may have been an impetus to pass this legislation after D-Day.
Dennis Douglas, with the Department of Veterans Affairs, says the GI Bill had been stalled in Congress.
And the fact that we were now engaged in major battles may have been a significant turning point to pass the legislation.
But when the joint House-Senate conference formed to determine the final shape of the bill, members deadlocked. The deciding vote belonged to Representative John Gibson, who had pledged to support the GI Bill. But he was back home in Georgia and had given his proxy to another Southerner, John Rankin, the man who feared the bill could desegregate the South. Rankin saw this as his last chance to kill the bill. Professor Kathleen Friedel says when the American Legion got wind of this, it launched a mad search to deliver John Gibson and his vote.
And so the American Legion desperately tries to get hold of Gibson, but it's clear that he's playing poker on a stormy night in Georgia. And they finally contact the Hearst newspapers because the Hearst newspapers held telephone priority and could use the phones. Because we have to remember, this is World War II, and not everyone could have telephone priority. So they held the line, and they contacted local radio stations throughout Georgia saying, you know, have you seen Congressman Gibson? Have you seen Congressman Gibson? Where is he? And so they finally locate him at this poker game, and they say, get up to Washington, because Rankin is going to cast your proxy vote with him and kill the GI Bill. And Gibson says, I have no money. So he raided the kitty of the poker game to get money to fly up to Washington, D.C., so he could vote his own vote for himself, and in the way that the American Legion wished he would, which is for the GI Bill. And so it was a very dramatic series of events because it was a stormy night, and they finally get him to Washington, D.C., and he marches into the conference room the next morning, and he says, you know, while our boys are dying on the shores of Normandy, why are we stalling for passing a benefit program for them? And he dramatically casts his vote that broke the conference deadlock.
President Roosevelt signed the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, known as the GI Bill of Rights, on June 22, 1944. However, the bill received little fanfare. A program to benefit men and women leaving the service hardly mattered to a public watching its sons and daughters still being sent overseas.
And I checked in at Fort Lewis, and I shortly became a member of the United States Infantry.
Bill Gates Sr., born in 1925, received his enlistment papers at age 18.
And then I'm shipped off to the war in the East.
In 1945, the man who would go on to chair the Gates Foundation, overseeing an endowment of $28 billion, was sent to fight the Japanese. Dennis Douglas says the recently passed GI Bill had little impact on those soldiers.
There are so many things that goes through one's mind when bullets are flying, or when you're preparing to go into battle, or when you've just come out of battle. The news probably didn't travel near as fast as it does today, and I don't think it really was a large part of the mindset of the GI at the time.
Poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti had little idea how much of an impact it would have on his life.
No, I didn't. We were too busy on the sea. I mean, I didn't have a desk job the whole 4 years. Just one ship to another. I didn't have any papers to read.
The soldiers were busy fighting in the Pacific Theater, building the massive Allied fleet for the expected invasion of Japan. Then suddenly, the war was over.
Mobile unit in the heart, center, and the pulsing focus of a joyous nation, a time-sparing New York City. Ben Brown reporting as I stand, literally stand, tiptoe, sticking my head outside to save the great teletop of the NBC mobile unit and look uptown over a foaming, seething, writhing mass of faces, lifted joyously and buoyantly and gloriously happy at the final conclusion of a desperate war which has seen its closing days and a desperate day.
In the heady days following the end of World War II, millions of GIs were returning to America.
There were a whole lot of us who were enjoying the fact of not being in the Army or the Navy or whatever anymore.
Bill Gates Sr.
And yeah, there was just the whole business of the war having ended and ended successfully from the point of view of an American citizen. It was an exciting, optimistic time, yes.
The newly returned soldiers began using their GI Bill benefits immediately. Veterans Affairs Education Director Dennis Douglas.
There were several thousand who began schooling in late 1944 and early 1945. They may have come off active duty for disabilities or whatever, but they were back home and discharged from the military, and they started pursuing their education or training.
But it wasn't until after the war ended when veterans started an unprecedented rush to college.
The real actual crush that many people associate with the GI Bill, which is to say all of the veterans on campus, the throngs of them, those years are really clustered in 46, 47, 48.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti says all the GIs were talking about it.
Well, it's just something like you heard about and say, hey, did you know you could go to school on this thing called the GI Bill? And they'll pay everything, so...
Higher education, previously the domain of wealthy families, was suddenly open to the masses. And many college administrators predicted the new class of uneducated soldiers would soil the ivory tower.
You know, I don't know anything to say except that that point of view was turned out to be pure nonsense.
Bill Gates Sr.
What happened was the opposite of what the naysayers would have predicted.
The Veterans Administration paid tuition up to $500 a year. This was at a time when a year at Harvard was only $400. Dennis Douglas says the government also provided living expenses.
The monthly stipend, I believe, was $50 a month when the GI Bill was first enacted, and I believe grew to $75 a month by 1948.
After the war, I was working actually in the mailroom at Time Magazine, Rockefeller Center, New York City, and most of the crew in the mailroom at Time, we were all ex-GIs. So I quit and went, after about 8 months at Time, I quit and went to Columbia Graduate School. And I got an MA there, and then I went to University of Paris Graduate School there for 3 years. Got a doctorate there, so that was all on the GI Bill.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
You could go anywhere in the world. That's what a lot of GIs didn't realize, they could do that. They could go anywhere in the world. It's one, any accredited university or school, fantastic opportunity. The GIs of later wars didn't have such a great bill. It's pretty fantastic. You had to get there on your own. They didn't pay transportation, but they paid the tuition and books and $65 a month, I think it was, which in Paris was plenty to live on in 1946, 47, 48, 49, 1950, I was there. We were the conquerors and we set the exchange rate. And so it was really great with the American dollar in those days, much different than today. Yeah, I mean, I had $65 a month, I had about twice as much money as any of the French students I hung out with.
Ferlinghetti completed his PhD at the Sorbonne and returned to the States, settling in San Francisco.
Actually, I had a few months left. You could go for the same amount of time you were in the service. If you were in 4 years, you got 4 calendar years of GI Bill. So I got out here, and I still had 3 or 4 months or couple of months left, so I went to graduate school at University of California, Berkeley, one summer. And that just about finished up my time on the GI Bill.
Soldiers were hungry for education. Colleges and universities around the country saw student populations explode. Harvard's enrollment doubled from the spring of 1946 to the fall. Nationally, veterans were becoming a significant presence on campus. The framers of the GI Bill had expected the unemployment benefits of $20 per week for 52 weeks, known as the 5220, to be the most widely used. Dennis Douglas.
But if you look back on the statistics, on average, the veteran only used about 17 weeks of those unemployment benefits.
That's because they were too busy getting an education. It was the biggest surprise of the GI Bill. Instead of going back to their hometowns and spending a year on the dole, returning soldiers went straight to school. It's what transformed America.